Hello, and welcome to Resources Radio, a weekly podcast from Resources for the Future. I'm your host, Kristen Hayes. Just a few days ago, on March 6th, 2024, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC, released its final rule related to mandatory disclosure of climate-related risks faced by publicly traded companies. And the SEC proposed an initial version of this rule in March 2022, so over 2 years ago, and at long last voted on the final version, which did offer some important changes from the original proposal. So this rule is one that we've been keeping an eye on here at Resources for the Future, given its relevance for climate action across the economy, and we wanted to spend a little time here on Resources Radio parsing out its content and its import. So joining me to do that is Jim Cox, the Brainerd Curry Distinguished Professor of Law at Duke University and an expert in corporate and securities law. Stay with us. Hi, Jim. It is a pleasure to talk with you today, and I'm really glad you could join us here on Resources Radio.
Great to be talking with you, and I'm excited about participating.
Great. Yeah, so let me thank you again for joining me really just days after the, I believe it's an 886-page final SEC rule came out. I know that's a lot to digest. But quickly, before we actually get into the meat of the rule, I wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about your background and your areas of expertise.
Well, I've been writing and teaching in corporate securities law subjects for now over 50 years. I've been at Duke for 45 years, and I was at four other schools before that, before I came to Duke to finally get a steady job. So I came to Duke with tenure out of California. And I write a lot about not just the content of regulation, but the enforcement of regulation. And so, and I blend a mix of empirical work with theory. And I have a number of books out there that keep me busy and keep me engaged in subjects such as this.
Great. Well, it sounds like you're a deeply informed candidate to talk to us about this complicated rule. So let me dive right in and ask you kind of a foundational question first, which is maybe if you could just take us back to why the SEC has an interest in climate-related risks and really the greenhouse gas footprints of these publicly traded companies in the first place. Why is that something they care about?
So I've always seen the SEC, particularly in its regulatory initiatives, being a mirror of society, what's happening on capital markets particularly. And I think that that's what was happening here. We knew for a long period of time that not only was there a growing interest in what we now call as ESG issues, but particularly an emphasis on the E issue. As we're all aware, climate change is real. It's taking place. It's moving much more rapidly than anybody had ever predicted, even 5 years ago. So, I mean, quite frankly, the horse had left the barn, that there's lots and lots of voluntary disclosure engaged in by industry about environment, because this is a major risk that has to be addressed. It's a change that's taking place throughout the economies of around the world. And we're all linked together with this one threat, which is climate change. So it's natural for the SEC to start reflecting these concerns. And if I can just go on just a little bit more, you know, a paramount concern, if you read the tone and content and rationalization and then the approach that the SEC embraces in this final release here, is to enable investors and voting shareholders. Those are two buckets, and we can come back and talk about those buckets being two of the key missions of the SEC, facilitating investment behavior, but more importantly, enabling intelligent, informed voting decisions for those who oversee corporations. And so, but there was just wide variances in practices. And so one of the mantras of the SEC from its very initial beginning in the dark days of the Depression is facilitating comparability across issuers. And so we didn't have truly standardized practices. For example, you have some companies that made environmental disclosures. A big cohort that did make environmental disclosures, but they didn't follow the same format. They didn't use the same terminology. They didn't speak the same language. Okay, and didn't give the same emphasis. And there just needed to be, for comparability purposes, the SEC to step forward, and it did do that with this final release.
Interesting. Well, you've already sort of touched a little bit on my next question, which was about what was really driving the creation of the proposed and final rule. Beyond the mandate, it sounds like SEC itself has a mandate to sort of provide best information or encourage best information related to, you know, good corporate decision making for investors. So was it investor demand for this information? You've sort of hinted at that. Did it actually come from the Biden administration or from others sort of in the policymaking space? What were some other drivers?
I think the credit really should go to the market. The market needed this information. We know there's been not only just an explosion of indexed investing that was going on, but part of that indexed investing was driven by environmental concerns. And so you had a substantial section of money that's flowing into funds that were going to be ESG funds or mainly environmentally sane funds. And investors were allocating huge, I mean, you're talking about billions of dollars to these funds. And the question was just comparability. So I think the key feature here is standardization of disclosure, where disclosure is taking place. If I could just go further, you know, what's impressed me with the 800 plus pages of the release, the final adopting release, is what I would describe as the conciliatory, sensible tone throughout. And let me just give you what I just say is one of those, that standardization could happen in lots of different places. One, we can think that all reporting companies, you know, those thousands of companies that are required to be subject to filing 10-Ks and 10-Qs and in the reporting system of the SEC, you know, you could have one standardization of saying for those companies, this is what has to be disclosed and how it's going to be disclosed. And that facilitates comparability across investors, okay? But the other standardization that occurred is, again, part of the conciliatory tone. The SEC said, look, we're not going to say you have to disclose this. We're not mandating disclosure. But if you step forward, and this is classic, you know, Chicago school freedom of the market thinking, okay, if you do step forward, then we want to make sure it's comparable. And so when you do start talking about these matters, okay, then this is the format and this is the content that you need to be doing this with. And that facilitates comparability. So it's, and what I just got through saying is there's many, many instances in the final rules where the SEC said, we decided not to make this mandatory. We decided not to be prescriptive here. But the but is if you're going to talk about this specific subject, okay, then here are the metrics that you should be using. So we're all talking the same language. And how that relates to what we call basically signaling theory that we associate with the freedom of the marketplace thinking in the Chicago School of Economics and certainly law, okay, is the idea of letting companies start signaling to the marketplace through their disclosures that we've got a good handle on the risks that are being posed to us by climate change. And here we're signaling that we're on top of it and we're got a great management team, a better management team than those who aren't signaling. So you let the forces of the marketplace sort of sort things out by being facilitative of saying, okay, if you want to start talking about this subject, do it in a way that's comparable, and that's going to enhance the quality of the signal that you're sending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting. And you just indicated that they've perhaps stepped away. I don't know if that's fair. You should correct me if I'm wrong. But my understanding is that the initial rule actually did have more sort of mandatory nature to it, and that it required firms to report a couple of different types of emissions. So what we refer to as scope one emissions, which are really direct emissions. They're indirect emissions from using electricity, which are also referred to as scope two emissions. And then the emissions associated with, you know, everything along the supply chain. So upstream emissions produced by suppliers, downstream produced by consumers. Those are referred to as scope three. That's a huge bucket of emissions that can be very challenging to measure. And so, again, please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that in the proposed rule, which came out nearly 2 years ago, that those were mandatory. And it sounds like that's different in this final rule.
It is. The tone of the final rules is not only vastly different than what we saw 2 years ago. You know, 2 years is a short period of time, but it's also a long period of time in regulation. And if you think about it, 2 years ago, we barely had the Gensler administration in place. We're talking about its division heads, et cetera, the staff. They're starting to learn how to work together. But, you know, the comment period was incredible. And there's a lot of thoughtful comments that were advanced. And the reason this report is almost 900 pages, we keep saying over 800, but it's almost 900 pages long, is the thoughtfulness in which they collected, collated remarks that were coming in from, you know, from quite a range of comments on almost everything, and dealt with the questions and then synthesized them. This was truly the, you know, I think, the classic illustration of the wonders of the administrative process, okay, with these agencies to be able to do something like this. You could never see Congress being able to handle anything like this. It's set up that way. I think the SEC staff really did a great, great job here.
Of handling, I believe it was 16,000 comments that were received on this. So yeah, a lot of work went into sort of digesting that feedback. So can you say a little bit more about, you know, as they were digesting that feedback, how this final rule actually differs in terms of emissions reporting, and maybe how that reflects what your understanding was from some of those comments?
Yeah, well, let's take the one that's getting all the press right now, the so-called backing off on scope three. Okay. And I don't want to go into that because I would be the first to admit that suddenly drags me out of my depth, because I don't consider myself a scientist. I don't consider myself an environmentalist in the sense of knowing all the nuances that go into measuring, assessing, and evaluating greenhouse gases. But, you know, I think that was a sensible approach. It was a sensible approach, not only that you're going to be challenged if you had this, but I also think it's a sensible disclosure approach to not having scope three. And if I could just elaborate upon that just a little bit. Of all the areas that were identified in the proposal almost 2 years ago, okay, that was the most problematic in terms of the quality. And I want to emphasize that the quality of the information, okay, that was going to be mandated, okay, it was a scope three. And I say that because it was most vulnerable, not just because of the quality of information, but because of the gigantic expense related to even getting close to having something that was resembled the trustworthy release of information. And that's because you're being asked to disclose information not about something that's in your shop, in your business that you have control over, in which you have an accounting system that management depends upon to figure out how the ship is being steered through the water, the troubled waters that the company has to pass through to make money for their shareholders. But you're talking about disclosing something that's outside of the area you control. And immediately the expense of gathering that information, the problematic question about whether you could even get that information, but the trustworthiness of that information, I think, goes way, way down. And so you add that together, it's not clear to me that the scope three was going to be worth the candle that you had to light, okay, to create that amount of information. So that's one point. And then I must stand back from that sort of a blunderbuss statement and make it an equally broad one here like that. We are entering into a new terrain here about disclosure. To be sure, about 20% of the reporting companies do make environmental disclosures. And to be sure, there is an industry-led group that's laid out a template for how these disclosures ought to occur. Okay, all that sounds like, wow, it's all there. It's off the shelf. No, we don't have the rich experience yet. And so quite frankly, Before you can run, you have to walk. Before you can walk, you have to be able to crawl, okay? And I think that's where we are. This is a learning curve. As somebody who's been in this field for over a half a century and has followed closely the mandatory disclosure rules and the evolution of disclosure rules, okay? You know, I remember when there was no management discussion and analysis, okay? That went back 40 years ago, okay? And I remember the brickbats that were being thrown at the SEC about the MD&A disclosures, okay? And anybody who's followed that over the 40 years has seen that even the MD&A disclosures has been a learning curve. You know, it's been a lot of jousting back and forth between the registrants, okay, what they're disclosing, and the staff of the SEC issuing several releases, okay, scolding companies about not owning up consistently about the MD&A. And, you know, so that was evidence of a learning curve. So we're not going to fix this right away, okay? But we're going to gain a lot of experience as we run along the road. And I think the tone of the release and the contours of the rules, the texture of the rules that were adopted in the final report, lay a fertile ground for us to have things growing out of these over many, many years. That's going to enable us as we move forward to tweak them from time to time. And, wherever we wind up, it's going to be very different than where we are right now. But you had to start someplace, and you had to start near terra firma. And I think we're pretty darn close on terra firma here.
Okay. Well, that's great. I have so many follow-up questions for you. But actually, before that, I want to start and admit, as an SEC newbie, I don't actually know what MD&A stands for. Could you just mention what that is?
Yes. Okay. A complaint that was being lodged in the 70s, again, a lot of the free market thinking, is that mandatory disclosure just tells you where you've been, and what investors want to buy is where you're going to be going. And tells management, now, if you see something that's in the current quarter or in the series of quarter and the financial reports, and it looks like past is not going to be prologue, then you need to flag that. That enables investors, okay, but it's also very good for management to think about these things.
Right. Yeah, this is really interesting. So a couple of additional follow-up questions for you. So you mentioned the term terra firma. I'd like to sort of parse that out with you in two different senses. So I will say, I feel like much of the sort of rapid fire reporting that's come out about this final rule has really described it, you know, the changes in emissions reporting and perhaps some other changes too, as quote, weakening, right? They've made the rule softer or less, you know, less teeth to it. So I guess I wanted to ask you, you know, do you feel like it's actually weakening, or do you feel like some of the changes have actually, let's say, strengthened the rule and actually put it on, you know, a different kind of platform? And that gets us into some of the legal questions too, which is, I know, an area of real expertise for you. And we, you know, we asked you, I think earlier back in 2022, we actually asked you about the legal basis for the rule and what sort of legal challenges it would face. And so, you know, now that this final rule has been released, I'd love to go back to that question too. What sort of legal challenges to this final rule do you anticipate? And is that part of your thinking when you say terra firma as well? Do you feel like this is on better sort of legal footing in the way that the SEC has revised the rule to kind of ensure that it will survive those legal challenges?
Yeah, terra firma, I've been using it, really is in the sense of more concrete, specific, quantifiable information. And I compare and contrast that with what I said earlier about the scope 3, which I think was more problematic in terms of how even auditable, whether it was could be verified in any meaningful way, the expectations you're going to have are created about your knowledge of what your suppliers are providing you, and in terms of their own experiences with greenhouse gases. So to be sure, I mean, it's noticeable in almost every section that's covered in this nearly 900-page release, where the SEC said, well, we decided not to do that from our proposal stage, and we backed up here. And these seem to be just, you know, keep, you're stepping back. My own feeling is they were stepping back to areas that could be verifiable. And I think that verifiable, okay, or more trustworthy information than the alternative would have been, that I think that that's the terra firma I'm talking about. And I think that that's a wise position. We may ultimately be able to have a system in which we can have something that resembles trustworthy information regarding scope 3 greenhouse gases. But my sense is that the industry group is not there quite yet, okay? And quite frankly, I think we have to pat the SEC on the back for moving forward and being more concrete than what was going on. Repeatedly, when you read the final adopting release here, there's references saying, look, the template that we were using here was the industry-led task force, okay? The so-called task force on climate-related financial disclosures, and that was an industry group. And what they did is they took that, which was widely used, the industry group on the ground, this is people trying to regulate themselves, deciding what best practices are, et cetera. And the SEC said, well, we're tweaking that. We're starting with that, but then we're filling it in. And in many instances, you'll find the report says, look, we're going beyond that. We're making it more concrete. I think that's all for the better. There's always been this symbiotic relationship between the regulated and the regulator, okay, in terms, particularly in the disclosure metrics that get applied. And I think that that's really important. Each learns from the other. And at the end, I think they're going to be facilitating a wiser, more trustworthy investment decisions that are being made. There's a tendency to talk more about investors because we're more aware of that. You get up in the morning and my Wall Street Journal got delivered this morning to see what certain stocks did yesterday. You're reading about firms, what have you like that. But you know what's really important as well, and it's another big button, and that is how these proxies get voted. They get voted. The nerve center of a corporation is the board of directors, and the owners of the firm elect those directors. And one thing we can't lose sight of the fact of is that we need information so those decisions are informed. And so it would be an error to say that everything that happened in this final release environment is just about enabling investors to buy and sell stocks. It also is an important governance tool. You need information about how they're greening the risk of our time, climate change, to be able to figure out who should be the stewards of the firm.
Great. Yeah. So let me ask you to just dive into that legal question just a little bit more as well in terms of the challenges that this rule is likely to face. From some of the commentary I've read, I do believe that, you know, this final rule is in fact still likely to face challenges. But, you know, in your view, has the SEC kind of, what has it done in its revisions, or has it done enough in its revisions to put that rule on firm legal ground?
Yeah, I think that the SEC, by backing off some of the imponderable questions, okay, for example, let's just take one of the things I think was really easy to take care of. So in the proposal, there was a proposal that companies should engage in scenario analysis, okay? And that's a modern day word for something else we all learned in our statistics class about trying to evaluate the future. And, you know, scenario analysis means that, look, you know, there's, you know, if we thought about, growing corn, we could think about that there's three states of the environment, okay? A lot of rain, a drought, or just the right amount of rain, okay? And then you can think about it any time of year, whether it looks like it's going to be a rainy year or a dry year, et cetera. That's scenario analysis. You look at what the outcomes are, and you measure what the expected outcome is. If there's a lot of rain, okay, and you assign a probability to it. Okay, that's pretty basic the first-year finance, quite frankly. And there's going to be mandating that firms should be thinking about scenario analysis, looking into the future, et cetera, and disclose the fruits of that mandated way of thinking about the future in your reports. You know, to me, that's pretty straight jacketing. You're telling management, maybe it's my conservative Kansas upbringing, okay, but it certainly makes me think that you're telling people how to think about a problem. And I thought the real reason that the markets disciplined managers who didn't think very well or didn't think about the problems at all. And so the best thing to do is shine a light on things about how do you think about climate change, but not mandate how they're going to think about it. See my point? And you know, and there can be lots of reasons why we don't want to have that happen. And when you start making scenarios there, you know, there's a lot of private information about your firm that goes into thinking about, well, what are going to be the 3 or 5 or 7 states of our business a few years down the road? And some of those could be, if you had to disclose those, then you're going to be disclosing how you're allocating resources within the firm to come out with a new product, a new marketing scheme, what have you, okay? And I think that that has a high degree of sensitivity. So the issue of the SEC backed off on scenario analysis, they say, look, if you engage in scenario analysis, then you disclose it, okay? And if that scenario analysis indicated that the plant you had on Miami Beach, okay, is going to be underwater in 5 years, and that's a material event, you got to disclose that too, which takes you right back pretty much to what we talked about earlier with the management discussion analysis. That's an existing condition that you're going to lose this plant. It probably ought to be disclosed. There's a lot of things that the SEC did that I think complement current practices, but nevertheless are introducing a certain amount of rigor and consistency that facilitates comparability. And what you'd like to have with this facilitating of comparability is more people step forward and start doing it, okay, and realizing that this can be a benefit, signaling to the market that you're on top of the problem. Companies always have to worry that they'll be embarrassed by their lack of disclosure. So I'm going to presume that as we move in this world and we see expectations for more robust disclosure, which is certainly what we see in the final rule that's adopted here. And as we get more and more aware of the costs of climate change, cutting corners on climate change disclosures can likely result in a very embarrassing story being in the front pages of your local newspaper.
Right. Okay. Well, Jim, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Resources Radio, a podcast from Resources for the Future. If you have a minute, we'd really appreciate you leaving us a rating or a comment on your podcast platform of choice. Also, feel free to send us your suggestions for future episodes. This podcast is made possible with the generous financial support of our listeners. You can help us continue producing these kinds of discussions on the topics that you care about by making a donation to Resources for the Future online at rff.org/donate. RFF is an independent, nonprofit research institution in Washington, D.C. Our mission is to improve environmental, energy, and natural resource decisions through impartial economic research and policy engagement. The views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the podcast guests and may differ from those of RFF experts, its officers, or its directors. RFF does not take positions on specific legislative proposals. Resources Radio is produced by Elizabeth Wasson with music by Daniel Ramey. Join us next week for another episode.